Thank you so much. I want to offer a defense of political Augustinianism. But I do not mean by that term the sort of Augustinianism in politics that is perhaps most familiar in the United States. In America, when one claims to be Augustinian in political matters, it most often means that one espouses a kind of political pessimism of the sort propagated by Reinhold Niebuhr. Man is so infected by sin that all his common projects end up turning out badly, and so one can't expect very much from politics. That is not what I will be defending. Rather, what I will be defending is the view that temporal authority can be just when it recognizes that temporal ends are not the highest ends, and when it therefore subordinates itself to spiritual authority, such that it attains temporal ends in such a way that they serve spiritual ends. In other words, I will be defending Catholic integralism. This is the view taught in late antiquity by popes such as St. Gelasius I in the 5th century and St. Gregory the Great, end of the 6th century, beginning of the 7th century. And their teaching was further developed by the medieval popes, especially in their many controversies with rulers. Most famously, Pope St. Gregory VII in the investiture controversy with the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV. In developing these teachings, all of these popes appealed to premises taken from St. Augustine. Therefore, the French historian Monsignor Henri Xavier Archiller called this teaching political Augustinianism in a very influential little book that he published in 1933. He argued in that book that the development of Augustinian premises by medieval popes and theologians resulted in a doctrine that amounts to an absorption of the natural law institution of the state by the ecclesiastical law of the church. And he thinks that this obscures the true wisdom of Christianity, which distinguishes between a natural order with its own natural law and an order of grace that does not supplant or replace nature. Archiller argues that this development is rooted in Augustine's lack of a developed theory of the distinction between nature and grace and his totalizing understanding of supernatural justice. So Archiller thinks it's a bad thing. I think he's wrong. Augustine, Archiller thinks, was more subtle than the Augustinians who followed him in the Middle Ages. Augustine recognized that pagan empires had an authority granted to them by divine providence. And this element of his thought, Archiller thinks, gets lost in the kind of dumbed-down Augustinianism of the Middle Ages. Archiller's thesis has been more or less rejected by many later interpreters of Augustine. According to them, the medieval reading of Augustine was not just a bit simplistic, as Archiller suggests, but totally wrong. These writers fall into two groups, which I call the secularists and the post-secularists. The best case for the secularists was made by Robert A. Marcus, a British historian, in a book called Saeculum. According to Marcus, a more careful reading of Augustine shows us that his idea of the saeculum, the present age, in which members of the two cities, the city of God and the city of man, are mixed together and have to come to some kind of practical agreement, should lead us Christians to accept a liberal theory of separation between church and state. The other group, the post-secularists, rejects Marcus's liberal reading of Augustine, and give very good arguments for rejecting Marcus, but their own positive proposals then are less convincing. They tend to be kind of vague, and there are many different ones. I will look at only one, proposed by William T. Kavanaugh, an American Catholic theologian. Although Kavanagh rejects Marcus's secularism, nevertheless he also rejects medieval political Augustinianism. He argues that Augustine's principles should lead to something more like the Christian anarchism of Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic worker movement, in which the church stands as a witness against the earthly powers to which she can never be reconciled. So I'm going to reject all three readings of Augustine, Akiem, Marcus, and Kavanagh. Against Marcus and Kavanagh, I will argue that Augustine's principles do indeed support something like medieval political Augustinianism. But against Akiem, I will argue that medieval political Augustinianism does not involve a confusion about the relation of nature and grace, but rather a profoundly true understanding of the way in which the natural end is ordered to the supernatural end. So I will argue that we should ourselves adopt such a political Augustinianism and be Catholic integralists. The question that Augustine addresses in the City of God is a question that goes back to the beginning of Christianity. As St. Paul writes to the Corinthians, the gospel of the cross is a scandal to the Jews and folly to the pagans. The Jews were expecting the Christ to restore the Davidic kingdom, overthrow the Romans and Herodians, and establish a universal kingdom of peace. A new David, who is executed as a criminal, makes no sense. In accusing Jesus before Pilate, the Jews say, anyone who makes himself out to be a king is challenging Caesar. John 19:12. But to Pilate, the pagan official, Jesus' wisdom is unintelligible. My kingdom is not of this world, says Jesus, John 18:36. And Pilate is puzzled. Then you are a king? He asks. To Pilate's Roman mind, earthly political rule is concerned with guiding human beings to their highest good, with educating souls toward virtue, and therefore it directs all other human pursuits. Pilate would have, as a schoolboy, learned Virgil's Aeneid, which portrays Rome as having a divine mission to spread the rule of law over the whole world, and thereby to preserve what was best about the Greek philosophical ideal of the city-state, concern with the common good, the res publica of the citizens, but at the same time to overcome the petty particularism of the Greek polis by realizing the Stoic ideal of a universal society of all rational beings. To the Romans, there was no distinction between religion and politics, such as moderns would make, nor even between spiritual and temporal power, such as the medievals would make. The worship of the gods was simply one of the things that the ruler ordered for the common good of Rome. And in the following centuries, the Christians continued to be a puzzle to the Roman authorities, who could not understand why they were unwilling to give divine honors to the emperor, even though they claimed to be obedient imperial subjects. After the conversion of Constantine, this puzzle calls for deeper reflection. The question arises, can Christianity fulfill the traditional role of religion in the Roman Empire, securing the favor of the gods? And some Christians think this is what Christianity will do. Eusebius of Caesarea, in his praise of Constantine, gives precisely such an account. But the sack of Rome by the Visigoths in 410 seemed to refute this idea. And many conservative pagan aristocrats took the sack of Rome as an argument to say, look, this Christian god obviously doesn't give a damn about Rome. We need to return to the worship of our ancestral gods. And it was to this argument that Augustine was responding in the City of God, which is subtitled, Against the Pagans. In elaborating his attack on pagan political theology, Augustine is led to expound the full scope of the Christian understanding of reality, of God and the world, and the way in which God's providential plan is realized in the course of human events. The result is a magnum opus et arduum, as he says, a great and arduous work, which shows that the story of human events is the story of two communities, the city of God and the earthly city. It was, of course, especially to this work, to the city of God, that medieval and late antique political Augustinians from Gelasius I to Gregory VII and beyond, Innocent III, Boniface VIII, and so on, were to appeal again and again. In the introduction to the second edition of Political Augustinianism, Acquier manifests what he sees as the problem by juxtaposing two papal documents. The first document is Pope St. Gregory VII's second excommunication of Henry IV in the 11th century. And it shows the sort of political Augustinianism that Acquier finds problematic. Gregory claims that since the authority of the Roman Church, founded on the princes of the apostles, Peter and Paul, can bind and loose in heaven, therefore it can, quote, on earth take away empires, kingdoms, principalities, duchies, margravates, counties, and all possessions of men, end quote. Just as the Roman Church can deprive wicked and unworthy bishops of their sees and give them to devout men, so a fortiori it can do the same with secular offices. The second document that Acquier quotes is Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Immortale Dei from the 19th century. And it shows an understanding of the state based on a Thomist account of nature that Acquier thinks is correct. Quote now from Leo XIII. The Almighty, therefore, has given the charge of the human race to two powers, the ecclesiastical and the civil, the one being set over divine and the other over human things. Each in its kind is supreme. Each has fixed limits within which it is contained, limits which are defined by the nature and special object of the province of each. Acquier sees an apparent contradiction between these two documents. On the one hand, Gregory VII claims to have secular authorities at his disposal. He seems to have forgotten the natural law of the state, which, quoting now from Acquier, existed before the church, founded on the original demands of human nature, independent and sovereign in its domain. And to have absorbed the natural law into ecclesiastical law. On the other hand, Leo XIII seems unequivocally to affirm the fundamental natural law of the state as sovereign in human affairs. That is the problem that Acquier sees, and he makes no attempt at solving this problem. His book just gives an historical account of the genesis of the view of Gregory VII, and then he leaves it at that. Acquier's thesis was in some respects anticipated by a German historian, Ernst Bernheim, and Acquier approaches Augustine's teaching through a critical reading of Bernheim. For Bernheim, the key Augustinian concept is peace, the tranquility of order, a state of harmony in which created reality fulfills its nature, finding its place in the cosmos, and through this subordination participates in the unity of being in God. And Bernheim appeals here particularly to the so-called Table of Peace in City of God 9:13, where Augustine describes peace as the harmony between the parts of any whole, and especially the harmony between rulers and subjects, especially between creatures and God. And here a supernatural element comes in, because peace between men and God consists in well-ordered obedience of faith to eternal law. From this, Bernheim draws the following conclusion. Now a quote from Ernst Bernheim. Of course, true peace in this sense can belong only to the children of God, who know themselves to be united with him. The children of the world, of the devil, who trust in themselves, are brought through their lack of order under the domination of the passions. They are driven this way and that in restless dissensions with themselves and others, and they envy the peace of the citizens of the city of God. These are the two cities, a heavenly city founded by the love of God even to the contempt of self, and an earthly city founded by the love of self even to the contempt of God, as Augustine puts it in City of God 14. Bernheim argues that the pagan empires are images of the earthly city, founded and continued in violence, selfishness, and pride. Akia admits the plausibility of Bernheim's case in the light of Augustine's polemic against Rome. Cicero had defined the res publica as the common good of a people who are bound together juris consensu et utilitatis communione, by a common sense for what is right and by a community of interest. But Augustine asks, how can there be a common sense for what is right, jus, when there is no justice, justitia? Justice is, after all, to give each his due, his jus. A true common sense of jus would therefore mean that justice was being done. But in Rome, justice was undermined at its root, because she did not give God his due. The Romans did not worship God, who created them. Rome was therefore not truly a res publica, a common good, at all. It was an instantiation of the earthly city. But Accia goes on to argue that Augustine later qualifies this rejection of the legitimacy of Roman rule by giving a less strict sense of res publica, namely, a multitude of rational beings joined together by common agreement on the objects of their love. City of God, 1924. In this sense, Rome was a res publica, and in God's providence, men were obliged to obey her. Nevertheless, it was the original sharp polemic centered on a supernatural notion of justice that was to inform the Augustinian tradition. And Accia sees a first step here as being taken by Pope St. Gelasius I in his famous letter to the Byzantine emperor, Famuli Vestre Pietatis, more often known as Duo Sunt, from its most famous line. Quote now from Gelasius. For there are two, august emperor, by which the world is principally ruled, the sacred authority of pontiffs and the royal power, among which how much heavier is the burden of priests, for they will have to render an account to the Lord at the time of judgment, even for those very kings. We have here an ordered relation between mundane and spiritual rulers, in which the royal power has become just. Nevertheless, Accia argues that we do not yet have the full political Augustinian position. A quote now from Accia. The very term used by Gelasius is significant. Mundus hic, this world, as it appears to him, a mixture of Catholic, Arian, and pagan peoples. Later, we will only see the church. It will fill the whole horizon. Kings and emperors will be in the church. It will no longer be a differentiated world, subject to essentially different powers. It will be the same society, governed by often competing powers, united in the same faith, and subordinated to the same religious end. End quote from Akia. A further step is then taken by Pope St. Gregory the Great in his correspondence with rulers, both with the Byzantine emperor and with the Germanic barbarian rulers to the west. Gregory develops what Akia calls a ministerial understanding of secular power. Minister in Latin is, of course, servant. So the secular power serves the spiritual power. Quote now from a sermon of St. Gregory, a letter of St. Gregory the Great to the Byzantine emperor. For power over all men has been given from heaven to the emperor to this end, that they who aspire to what is good may be helped, and that the way to heaven may be more widely open, so that the earthly kingdom may serve the heavenly kingdom. Akia then traces the influence of these ideas in medieval political thought from St. Isidore of Seville in the 7th century to Jonas of Orléans and Smaragdus of Saint-Mihiel in the 9th, and so on down to the popes of the 9th century, where he sees the full position developed that will then be expressed so memorably by Gregory the 7th in the 11th century. So that's basically Akia's thesis. And this comes under attack right away. As soon as he publishes the book, there are French Augustinians attacking him. And particularly, there was a big conference on Augustine in Paris after World War II, where all the big theological names of the time were there. Henri de Lubac was there. Joseph Ratzinger was there. And they all agreed that Akia was wrong. And a particularly important talk at that conference was given by a French historian, not one of the theologians, namely Henri-Irénée Maroux. Maroux argued that since Augustine teaches that in this age, the saeculum, the citizens of the two cities are always mixed and can never be fully distinguished, this age represents a tertium quid between the two cities. And it's this idea of Maroux that then gets its fullest development in Robert Marcus's book, Saeculum. Marcus reads Augustine's vehement attack on Rome's pretensions as a rejection of the ancient understanding of politics on which those pretensions were founded. The understanding that politics is concerned with the common achievement of the highest goods of human life. Quote now from Robert Marcus. In Augustine's mature thought, there is no trace of a theory of the state as concerned with man's self-fulfillment, perfection, the good life, felicity, or with educating man toward such purposes. End quote. He reads Augustine's second definition of the res publica, a multitude of rational beings joined together by common agreement on the objects of their love, as opening up a radically new understanding of the political. The political is now a space of overlapping consensus, in which citizens of the two cities, with their different ultimate loyalties, agree on a minimal material security. Quote from Marcus, "The state is inherently pluralistic, being the sphere in which the concerns of individuals with divergent ultimate loyalties coincide." Political authority is necessary, on Marcus's account, to cancel out some of the effects of sin by restraining evildoers. It is necessary only now in this saeculum in which the two cities are mixed. Medieval political Augustinianism was un-Augustinian in its attempted re-sacralization of political power. Quote again from Marcus. Augustine's attack on the sacral conception of the empire liberated the Roman state, and by implication all politics, from the direct hegemony of the sacred. Society became intrinsically secular in the sense that it is not as such committed to any particular ultimate loyalty. It is the sphere in which different individuals with different beliefs and loyalties pursue their common objectives insofar as they coincide. His secularization of the realm of politics implies a pluralistic, religiously neutral civil community. Historically, of course, such a society lay entirely beyond the horizons of Augustine's world. End quote. So he's not saying Augustine was himself a secular liberal, but he is saying that we, if we understand Augustine's deepest principles, should welcome the secular liberal order in which we live now. Marcus looks beyond the city of God to all the texts of Augustine. Saeculum is a reading of the whole Augustinian corpus. And he does see one theme in Augustine that poses a problem for his interpretation. And this is Augustine's defense of the use of imperial troops to force the Donatists back into the Catholic Church. Augustine had originally been against using coercion against the Donatists because he thought it would create a large group of feigned Catholics to the detriment of the zeal of the community. But he changed his mind when he saw the real piety shown by many Donatists who had been forced back into the church and their gratitude for the coercion which led them to see the truth. Augustine develops a theory of a pastoral use of coercion. Quote, now from Augustine, "Not only is the wall of hardened habit breached by human terrors, but the mind's faith and understanding is at the same time strengthened by divine authority and reason." End quote. The Donatists had received in their baptism the gift of divine faith, but they are prevented from enjoying its fruit by obstinate habit. The application of external force liberates them from their bad habits and enables them to recognize the truth that is in their hearts. Quote again from Augustine, a beautiful, typically Augustinian line, "Foris inveniato necessitas, nascitur intus voluntas." Let necessity be found outside, the will is born within. So Robert Marcus has to ask, how does this fit with my account of Augustinian politics as being minimal? And he gives a kind of paradoxical argument that it is precisely Augustine's deconstruction of the political that then, which should lead him away from stuff like calling the troops in against the Donatists, that leads him then not to see the problem. It was precisely the atomizing effect of his theology of the saeculum that meant that when he was thinking about the Donatist question, Augustine didn't see the imperial troops as agents of the state. He wasn't thinking about the state at all. He was just looking at them as individuals within the church. Thus, paradoxically, it was precisely the formulation of those principles which really show why such coercion is wrong that disguised from Augustine, as Marcus says, the wrongness of such coercion. Towards the end of the 20th century, you get a reaction against Marcus's paradoxical reading of Augustine from what I call post-secular or post-liberal thinkers. For example, the Anglican theologians John Milbank and Rowan Williams. These post-secular theologians argue that far from implying that worldly politics ought to be individualistic and pluralistic, as Marcus thinks, Augustine is actually criticizing Roman politics for being too individualistic. Augustine is arguing in the City of God that the true city, the complete community in which the highest end of human life is attained as a common good, is not the ancient free civitas or polis, but rather the community of those who love God. The true city that will grant peace and unity to the world is not Rome, but rather the Church of Christ. This community is hidden now, living by faith in the fleeting course of time, but already it is submitting the whole world to a new law, the law of love and grace. The city of God is the true res publica, because she is united in the love of the true and supremely common good, God himself. The love of this true good is unifying because it is not competitive. It is not diminished by being shared. As Augustine says in City of God 15:5, anyone who is unwilling to share this possession will find that he does not possess it at all. But the more he is able to love the one who shares it with him, the greater he will find that his own possession of it becomes. Rome, in contrast, was not a true res publica, because she did not truly pursue the common good of her subject, but rather the love of praise, amor laudis, and the lust for domination, libido dominandi, of her rulers. These passions are destructive of true human community because they are by nature competitive. To have the glory of great praise presupposes that others receive less praise, and to dominate many demands many who are dominated. Thus, Romulus murdered Remus so that the whole glory of founding Rome could be his alone. This is the force of Augustine's reading of Cicero's definition of the res publica. Rome was unjust because it did not give God his due. Rome's civic life was turned into a mockery by that fundamental injustice, because, as Rowan Williams puts it, quote, a social practice which impedes human beings from offering themselves to God in fact denies that central impulse in human nature which Augustine defined as the unquenchable desire for God and his truth, end quote. Roman politics was therefore really anti-politics. Roman imperialists had claimed that Rome's rule over her subjects was just because it was advantageous to the subjects, like the rule of the soul over the body. But if the souls of the Romans did not serve God, then there was no legitimacy to the rule of their souls over their bodies, and much less to the rule of their city over other cities. The civic virtues of the Romans were therefore, in a sense, vices. They were able to subordinate the passions to reason, but since reason itself was enslaved to the lust of domination, their civic courage was really anti-civic. Since, however, on Augustine's view, evil has no independent being, but is always only a misdirecting of the good, it must therefore render an unwilling tribute to the good by imitating it. Thus, the Roman virtues bear a certain resemblance to true virtue, and the earthly peace that Roman virtues established is an imitation of true peace. Thus, in a less strict sense, Rome was a res publica, and Augustine can even take the virtues of the greatest Romans, of Marcus Regulus and Mucius Scaevola and others, their sacrifice of themselves for the common good, as an example to the city of God, to the citizens of the city of God. Those citizens, the citizens of the city of God, make a certain use of the earthly peace established by Rome and direct it toward the true peace of heaven, as Augustine says in City of God 19:17. And here Augustine counters the pagan suspicion that loyalty to the city of God would undermine concern for the common good of visible cities like Rome. On the contrary, as he argues in City of God 5:19, it is of great advantage for earthly peace if the rulers are Christians, since then they will have true virtue. So that's the post-secular critique of Robert Marcus, and I think it's devastating, completely destroys his position. But then when these post-secular theologians come to give their own positive account of how Augustine should inform contemporary politics, they begin to waver and are much less convincing. So I want to look now at one, namely Bill Kavanaugh. So Kavanaugh fully shares this critique from Milbank and Williams, and he interprets the point that the true politics is found only in the city of God in an anarchist direction. Worldly coercive power, according to Kavanaugh, belongs in the earthly city, which is always in conflict with the heavenly city. That earthly city is passing away, and the new city is already arriving at the same time and making use of the same temporal goods, but for a different end. The citizens of the new city reject the coercive politics of the city of man and live in anticipation of eschatological peace. Kavanaugh thinks that the tradition of political Augustinianism, beginning with St. Gelasius, took a wrong turn insofar as it flattened the temporal distinction between the two cities, the one that's passing away and the one that is coming, into a kind of spatial or functional distinction. So he explicitly quotes Gelasius and then says he's wrong. And he says, there is not one society in which there's a division of labor. Rather, there are two societies which are competing at the same time, and one is losing and the other is winning. He thinks Gelasius, by, as it were, dividing up functions between a temporal and a spiritual authority, actually contracts the concerns of the spiritual, which should be concerned with everything. So, quote now from Kavanaugh. There is no division of sacred and secular, private and public, no division of labor between the things that are Caesar's and the things that are God's. For, as Dorothy Day once commented, if you give to God what is God's, there is nothing left for Caesar. The reference to Dorothy Day is, I think, significant. Like Day, Kavanaugh thinks that Christians should live in a sort of pacifist, anarchist counter-community to earthly states, hollowing out the earthly society from within. Of course, Kavanaugh, too, has to admit that Augustine countenanced the use of coercive means for spiritual ends. But he wants to insist that coercive government and the peaceful city of God cannot really be integrated into one society. Coercive government will always remain outside the city of God and opposed to it. So it seems he doesn't say it quite as explicitly as Marcus, but it seems that he would agree with Marcus that Augustine's position on coercion of the Donatists is not really consistent with Augustine's deeper principles. Okay. So those are the positions. Now I'm going to show why they're wrong and what my position is. There's a recent paper by Eric Gregory and Joseph Clare that points out that both the post-secular critics of Marcus and Marcus himself agree that political authority is a result of sin. And both sides appeal to City of God 1915. God did not want a rational creature made in his own image to have dominion except over irrational creatures, not man over man, but man over beasts. But Gregory and Clare point out in this paper, and I think convincingly, that Augustine did not mean to deny that political rule is natural. And they appeal to a medieval reader of Augustine, who they think gives a better interpretation, namely St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas argues that the political common good is a locus of natural perfection, and since the common good of its nature demands a ruler who directs the multitude to it, there would have been political rule even without original sin. It would have obviously not made any use of coercive punishments, because it would have had no need of them, but still you would have one directing the many. And in the article where he argues for this, in the first objection to the article, Thomas cites the passage from the City of God that I just cited, about God not intending man to have dominion over man, but only man over beast. In the body of the article, Thomas distinguishes between two kinds of rule, one that is for the advantage of the ruler, who exploits his subjects for his own private advantage, and one for the sake of the subjects, where the ruler directs a multitude for the common good of that multitude. And Thomas argues that Augustine was only speaking about the former kind of rule, when he said God did not intend this for man. That is, he did not intend exploitative rule of man over man, whereas he did intend, in a way, that kind of rule of man over beasts. We rule over the beasts not primarily for their advantage, but for our advantage. Although in another sense, it's to the advantage of the whole of creation. And St. Thomas refers to the immediately preceding text in the City of God, before the line that I just quoted. Now, quote again from City of God, Book 19, chapters 14 and 15. In the household of the just, who lives by faith, even those who give commands are at the service of those whom they appear to command. For they do not give their commands out of any desire for domination, but rather out of dutiful concern for others, not out of any pride in ruling, but rather out of compassion in providing for others. This is what the order of nature prescribes. This is the way God created man. End quote from Augustine. Marcus had argued that that last bit, this is the way God created man, should not be read with what comes before it, but with what comes after it, which is the bit about man ruling over the beasts and not over other men. Marcus recognizes, though, that there are other texts that seem to say the opposite. For example, there's a text in Augustine's literal interpretation of Genesis, where, again, he makes a distinction between two kinds of rule. He's talking about rule in the family. Augustine thinks the father would sort of direct the other members of the family, even if there had been no original sin. But Marcus argues that while we can conceive of that, that is, of a father ruling over a family without coercion, we cannot conceive of non-coercive politics. Politics, he thinks, is essentially coercive. But as Gregory and Claire argue, I think convincingly, Marcus is here imposing a kind of modern Hobbesian or Weberian understanding of politics on Augustine, and he's not really doing justice to the text. Like Aquinas, they argue, Augustine sees humankind's natural sociality expressed in a series of concentric moral circles extending outward from the family to civil society and the ecclesial community. And they see this expressed even more clearly in Augustine's letters to government officials than in the City of God. They refer especially to letter 155, which Augustine wrote to the Roman vicar of Africa, Macedonius, which is written around the same time as the City of God. And here, quote from that letter, 155. The source of blessedness is not one thing for a human being and another for a city. The city is indeed nothing other than a like-minded mass of human beings. And Augustine then goes on to say to Macedonius, if you look at all your virtues with which you rule Africa, and if you are using these virtues only for the bodily good of the people of Africa, and not to direct them beyond that, not to see how they use the peace that you establish in Africa for their true good, namely the worship of God, then your virtues aren't real virtues. They're only real if you're really directing them to what is really the true final aim of human beings, which is the same whether you're talking about one human being or a society. As Gregory and Claire point out, the letter shows that Augustine thinks political rule is natural in the sense of being a constitutive element of the social well-being that human beings were created to pursue. But at the same time, the letter shows that the natural virtue pursued by political rule has to be ordered to the end of worshiping God in order to lead to true happiness. Hence, medieval political Augustinianism was authentically Augustinian in holding that political rule can be just, when it is brought into an ordered relationship with the spiritual hierarchy. R.W. Dyson, in an excellent book on Augustine's political philosophy, has shown this by very thorough and careful reading of the texts and comparison then to St. Gelasius and some of the other later readers of Augustine. He agrees that their reading was somewhat selective of Augustine. Nevertheless, like Acquier, he argues that the medieval political Augustinians followed the theological and metaphysical principles that Augustine lays out to their most logical conclusion. He illustrates this by reference to another letter of Augustine's, letter 134 to the proconsul of Africa, Apringius, in which Augustine suggests that the proconsul rules over bodily life, while he as bishop has the rule of the life of the soul. Thus, there is a functional distinction between worldly and spiritual authorities. Augustine's relations with the Roman governors in Africa was not a competitive one. And in trying to enlist their help in his aims, he doesn't talk about the order between them, which one is higher, me or you. He treats them, as it were, as his equals. But it is clear that for Augustine, the soul is superior to the body. And therefore, the relation between bishops and governors is, as Dyson says, asymmetrical. In a changed situation, therefore, in which disputes arose between rulers and bishops, it was logical for the political Augustinian position to emerge. Dyson notes that it was only 70 years after Augustine that Pope St. Gelasius I, a North African pope, by the way, wrote Famuli Vestae Pietatis. And Dyson surmises, in fact, that Gelasius had Augustine's letter to Apringius in front of him when he was writing Duo Sunt. And as Archier shows, the position of popes like Gregory VII was essentially a development out of the principles laid down by Gelasius. So where does this leave us with respect to Archier's thesis that in political Augustinianism, the natural law of the state is absorbed into the supernatural law of the church? We have seen that Augustine regards political authority as being a natural element of the human social good, but that it has to come into a relation with the supernatural good, just like all natural goods have to be healed by Christ. Rightly understood, therefore, political Augustinianism does not deny the natural common good of particular cities. Grace does not destroy nature. It liberates it. As Augustine puts it in City of God 15, what gives birth to citizens of the earthly city is a nature vitiated by sin, and what gives birth to citizens of the heavenly city is grace liberating that nature from sin. The tradition of political Augustinianism never lost a certain Augustinian realism, and now I'm using Reinhold Niebuhr's sense of realism, realism in inverted commas, with regard to sin. This is why authority remains diarchical. We talk about the Gelasian diarchy, Gelasius distinguishing between two principles of rule. The pope does not simply become the king of the world, directing secular rulers the way a political ruler would direct his military officers. Because of the wounds of sin, it would be dangerous for spiritual rulers to have such direct concern for temporal affairs. Hence, St. Gelasius writes in Tractate 4 that Christ distinguished the two powers on account of human frailty and human pride, so that each order would be humbled by the need for the other, and especially so that priests would not be involved in secular affairs. Nevertheless, because the spiritual end is superior to the temporal end, spiritual power does have the authority to intervene in secular affairs, ratione peccati, as the medieval popes say again and again, on account of sin. That is, when secular rulers are hindering the spiritual end by sinning or commanding sin. Even in the most extravagant claims of papal authority that you get towards the end of the High Middle Ages, for example, in Boniface VIII's controversy with Philip the Fair of France, Boniface is very careful to note the powers established by God are two, and I can only depose the King of France on account of sin. The opposition that Acquier sees between Gregory VII on the one hand and Leo XIII on the other is therefore illusory. It appears that Gregory sees one single community, the Church, or the Christendom, in which there are two functionally distinct powers, whereas Leo XIII sees two relatively complete communities, Church and State. But if you read Immortale Dei, Leo XIII goes on to say that between the two powers there ought to be, quote, a certain orderly connection which may be compared to the union of the soul and body in man. The more this soul-body relation is realized, the more the Church incorporates all peoples into herself, the less State and Church will relate to each other as two relatively complete communities, and the more there will simply be one community with two distinct powers, the Auctoritas Sacrata Pontificum and the Regalis Potestas. Both popes are teaching Catholic integralism. Politics should aim at man's true end. Does such an integralist teaching have any relevance for us today, when no temporal authority would recognize the spiritual authority in this sense? I think it does. And I think the application of it has basically two points. On the one hand, I think Kavanaugh is right that the Church has to show in her own communal life an attractive alternative to the anti-politics of the city of man. But on the other hand, I think Augustine's letters to Apringius and Macedonius and other rulers shows that we as citizens of the city of God should also engage in temporal politics and try to transform the temporal order as much as we can through our own agency, what Professor Vermeule, who is here today, calls integration from within. And here we see the solution to the puzzle of Christ before Pilate that, in a way, Augustine is dealing with in the City of God. Christ did not come into the world to destroy earthly rulers, which are founded in human nature, but he came to heal our political nature by suffering as a criminal, by suffering the penalty that we all deserve on account of our libido dominandi and our amor laudis. He atones for those sins and he enables us to be healed. He enables politics to become just. So Christ enables us to take political action. That political action can be good, but it will not necessarily be successful in the worldly sense. As Augustine points out, God does not always give earthly prosperity to Christian rulers, for, quote from City of God 5:25, no one should be Christian except for the sake of eternal life. Thank you very much.
We are adults, there will be as many practicing Catholics as there are Mormons. I'm very sympathetic to integralism, but it seems to me that it's almost as practical to found a political movement on the principles of Catholicism as it would be on the principles of Mormonism. So I guess I have two questions. Would it not be more prudent to focus our efforts on winning souls from other church And is it possible that integralism is in some ways a function of what Adrian actually calls Americanization in Catholic in Catholicism, or sort of an ideologization, trying to find political solutions for a problem that is not fundamentally political?
Well, I do think that the most important thing is the salvation of souls. So everything you do should be ordered to that. But I think that that sanctifying every realm of human existence is important to that endeavor, including the political. And I think that the abandonment of these Augustinian political principles by many Catholics was counterproductive in every respect, and is also one of the reasons why you have such a falling away from the faith. So there was this idea after the world wars in Catholic theology, a lot of very otherwise very intelligent Catholic thinkers, you know, Jacques Maritain and Henri Delubac and lots of these people. There was this idea that if we get rid of all this, you know, sort of not nice political stuff that you know we had in the Middle Ages, then everyone will become Catholic, right? The reason why people hate Catholics is because of the Inquisition and, you know, Gregory the VII and all this stuff. As soon as we get rid of that, you know, there'll be no reason for anti-clericalism. Everyone will see the truth of the gospel will shine like this bright light, and everyone will be converted. And this position, though I would argue it's not officially adopted at Vatican II, it does become sort of the accepted reading of Vatican II. And the expectation is, you know, there's going to be this new Christendom without the sort of regrettable aspects of the old Christendom. But the opposite happens. The opposite happens. When Catholics become liberals, the liberals don't all of a sudden become Catholics. Just the Catholics just become less Catholic. That's the only result. Yeah. You see this, for example, in the European Union as well, which is founded by Christian democratic parties. Robert Schuman, the father of the European Union, as we say, was friends with Jacques Maritain and was fully convinced of this project. And you look at the European Union today, you look at Christian democratic parties in Europe today, there's nothing left. And so I think that for the conversion of souls, you have to really have the courage to accept the whole truth, including the truth about politics.
Okay, so I have a question, but it might just be a clarification, like something I misunderstood.
Sure.
But it seems like the positive vision that you're giving is supposed to reconcile, like, I think you said showing this attractive alternative, but also transforming, I guess you're saying, like, what's already there, or the political order as it is. So I know that you said that has to be included in a positive vision, that's correct, but I don't actually understand how what you're proposing reconciles the two, or what Eric Gregory is proposing reconciles the two. It seems like it's just saying both are necessary, but I don't see how the tension is resolved, I think.
Yeah. So in this age, in the seculum, between the ascension of Christ and his return in glory, there will always be a remnant of sin. So there's the complete transformation will only come after the last judgment. So you have always this element of having to fight sin, but the more that people are converted, the less that is necessary. The less coercion and punishment will be necessary, and the more it will just be a communion of love, which includes directive authority, but not coercion. There's a brilliant book by American historian Andrew Willard Jones called Before Church and State. And he talks about this, how you have, you see in a way the temporal sword as kind of an Old Testament having a relation to an Old Testament element of our life now, relating to the spiritual sword kind of as the New Testament. And it's still necessary because you still have this struggle with sin in our time. But the more it becomes, the more the world is sanctified, the less the sword is necessary. Yes.
It was unclear whether, well, for each of them, how they saw the mechanism between the city of God and the city of man, between the church and the state. Sometimes it sounded like it was through papal action with a global reach, and sometimes it seemed like it was a bishop.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. That's one of the main themes and one of the main questions of debate throughout the Middle Ages. So you have most people agree on a basically Augustinian view and think that political authority can be Christian and can serve the ends of the city of God through fostering virtue and so on. But who is as it were at the top of the structure is going to be a matter of debate. So in the court theology in the Carolingian Empire, you have a certain amount of admission that, you know, the successors of the apostles and so on. But really the image you get is Charlemagne is the boss, and he's really sort of the ruler of the city of God. But obviously that's doesn't really make any sense, because the successors of the apostles are the ones who are immediately concerned with the final supernatural end. And so their authority, even in that text of Gelasius, you already see, so much weightier is the responsibility of the priest, because he has to give an account to God for the Pope, for the kings. And so right from the start, you get this development of a theory of papal authority over the whole church, the Pope as the successor of the princes of the apostles, Peter and Paul, and as the vicar, then later, even in Leo the Great, you get this idea of him as vicar of Christ and so on. And that is the most logical account that you can get. You get Gallican theologians who try to wriggle their way out of this, but they don't really succeed. Yes.
Quote from John 18, my kingdom is not of this world.
Yes.
And I believe the word for of there, the preposition is, it's ek in Greek and de in
right.
Latin, so maybe yeah. It's from this world even. But what bearing do you think this verse has on the question of interreligion?
Yes. Yeah, so this is... this, in a way, is the reason why you get a complex account. Why are there two powers, a spiritual power and a temporal power? It's because Christ, his kingdom is not of this world, and that means that he is not in competition with the kings of this world. He's not going to deprive them of their kingdoms. But he is going to heal their authority and bring them into a relation with the heavenly kingdom that is to come. After the last judgment, obviously, there's only going to be one king, Christ, who's going to rule the whole heavenly city. But in this age, he doesn't deny the authority of the kingdoms of this world that comes from human nature, which is created by God. So it comes from above. As he says to Pilate, you would have no authority over me if it were not given to you from above. That is, you as a human ruler with care for the common good have an authority that comes to you from God through human nature.
Thank you. So I'm able to grasp this idea of political Augustinianism, integralism in the abstract.
Yes.
But I'm having a really hard time picturing what it would actually look like if it were implemented today. you give an example of, you know, what would things look like, or what would some policy look like if the United States were to, you know, tomorrow adopt this approach?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to give a very concrete picture, because I think that many things would have to change before integralism would be adopted in the United States. So it's hard to say exactly what it would look like in America. You have many different examples of how it could look like in history. You have the Roman Empire under Theodosius, which is a lot different from the Kingdom of France under Louis IX. But maybe for us, the closer model is the Roman Empire at the time of Augustine, where you have the empire recognizes the truth of Christianity at the highest level, but the imperial institutions are not yet fully vivified by the ecclesial soul, to use Leo XIII's image. So you still have a lot of remnants of paganism, and in fact, you have a lot of imperial officials who are still pagans, especially senatorial class officials. And you have a slow process of a greater integration of the empire into Christianity. And that's the kind of thing, I think, that you would see with us. So if you read Augustine's advice to Roman officials, I think that would be good. It is a good kind of guide for what Christians involved in politics should be doing today.
So I'm curious, kind of on that same vein, how this vision of integralism incorporates, to what extent or at all, any elements of modernity. That is, that, you know, people like come to mind, François Fenelon thought there could be a sort of midway point between the moderns and the ancients, or kind of the Christians on this point and on the organization of government. To what extent do we need to throw out or get rid of, you know, these political elements of modernity in order to achieve integralism? Things like, robust property, or, you know, the sort of glorification of science and technological progress.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to distinguish what's good about in modern political and social institutions from what's bad in them, and from the philosophical justifications, modern philosophical justifications that are given for them. So there's, technology is a good thing sometimes. But obviously, this kind of ideology of technological progress that's behind the scientific revolution is false. So there's a work of discernment that's necessary. And the same will be true in political institutions. You can see that in a technological society, certain kinds of administration and so on, administrative organization of society, are necessary that had not been developed in antiquity and not in the Middle Ages. So you can look at certain forms of modern administration that are maybe necessary in a society with certain forms of technology, and you can distinguish that from the modern political project as it is conceived by Hobbes and others and carried forward. So yeah, it's a work of discernment, as Pope Francis would say.
Do we have time for one more question?
Me and Professor Gabriel.
No.
So I've heard integralism described as sort of the church moving from a position of concession, or even compromise concession position with regard to the liberal world order, into a position of actively contesting it, and slowly but surely coming to the conclusion that trying to integrate a liberal worldview and a Catholic worldview isn't really going to work. framework. Would you characterize that as an accurate assessment? And if so, what does this predict for the future?
What does this predict in the future?
Yeah. Where do you view the church going with integralism and its if it is indeed confronting the liberal worldview and the world order? Do you believe that this will inform Catholic politics more moving forward at an official level?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, to the first point, I think that's right. It is, there were, especially in the post-war period, there have been many attempts to sort of reconcile Catholicism and liberalism. And integralism is, one of the points of integralism is that that's not going to work. That liberalism has some essential principles that are false, and so we can't accept them. What will happen in the future is a very interesting question. I don't have the gift of prophecy. I don't know what will happen next. But I do believe that the church is founded on the truth. She's founded by Christ, and he's promised to preserve her in the truth. So I think that she's never going to finally commit herself to a false theory like liberalism.
On that hopeful note, please join me in thanking Father Evan.